You know, there's one Buddha Dharma, one world of reality. And there's one thing that's called Buddhism. It comes from Shakyamuni, one stream. And there are 1,000 different flowing rivers within that one stream, all the different schools and traditions. And our stream flows now all around this country, coming from Japan, from a deep spring called Eihei Dogen, Japanese Buddhist monk of the 13th century. There was something called Soto Zen, or in Chinese, Cao Dong school in China. Dogen was a 13th century Buddhist monk at a time in Japan where Zen really hadn't gotten started, first little trickles. And he felt that the teachings and schools available to him were not sufficient to answer his deep questions about life. And so he went with his, he found there sort of beginnings of Zen, and he went with his teacher to China. Teacher died there, never came back. It was an arduous thing to do at that time. He spent 4 years in China, and after traveling from one place to another, finally found a teacher with whom he settled, who turned out to be a Soto Zen teacher, Cao Dong School, and came, received a transmission as a teacher from this Chinese teacher, who encouraged him, to, of course, to go back to Japan. And he had his understanding came straight out of this great stream, and yet it was revolutionary. So he went back to Japan and developed, while saying, "I'm not starting a new school, I'm just doing the Buddha way," develop what we call Soto Zen. One of his earliest teaching statements about Zen is called Genjo Koan, or literally something like actualizing reality. He's playing with the word koan. It's not a case from a particular story from China. It's the what is the reality of our life? Maybe it could be translated as actualizing one reality in all the many bodies. That's really sort of what it's about. He wrote this for one of his lay students and revised it a couple of times in the great tradition of Zen teachers who endlessly revise everything. And in it, he sets out his view of what kind of world we're really living in and what our true relationship to it is. The whole thing is about 4 pages long, very dense and beautiful. And the first 3 sentences, he lays out his view of the universe and where we fit into it, how we can relate to it. So when we start practicing, we don't know anything about Eihei Dogen or Soto versus something different from something else, or we just start somewhere. And that's as it should be. We start somewhere, in some one body, in some one place, with some one bit of guidance. And we start with some particular intention, coming from our own suffering and confusion, usually, or yearning for a truth that will sustain us. We feel okay in our lives, but things feel a little strange. I had an email from one of my nieces. Some of you know them. They're 25. They're wonderful. She said, I'm feeling a need for, now her life is moving along nicely, 2.5 years out of college, a job, and a partner, a boyfriend, and living on West End Avenue, having a good time. And so she's one of those ones who at a time when it's not a great crisis, looks around and says, well, but this is fine, but isn't quite answering the questions of my life. So she said, how did you start practicing Zen? What led you to it? So all different kinds of starting places. We don't have to start in a crisis. Easier if we don't. It's always easier not to be in a crisis. We think we want peace or understanding. We know we want something, and somehow different from what is already. And these are all great ways to be, every single one of them. And they will all sustain you for quite a while. You often find that the motivation shifts a bit, too. You start out feeling dire, and then it shifts to something else, or dire comes up later. all of these particular avenues and places where we start are great Dharma doors. They all are what we call bodhicitta. They all awaken us to the idea that we want to understand something of the wisdom of life. But if you stay with your idea, now I'm a deluded being practicing so that maybe later on I can have a glimmer of enlightenment, that's an erroneous view that will in the end be a huge obstacle to your practice, even though it was a very good way to start. It's equally erroneous to keep on endlessly with, I'm going toward enlightenment, maybe it's just around the corner. I was one of those. Kind of. I lived in a very small house, 14 by 60. It didn't have, how many corners could it have? And I sat in that little cabin and it always was right around the corner. Or there's the enlightenment has nothing whatever to do with me. Thank you very much. I'm just a suffering being doing a modest practice for tranquility. Those are all equally erroneous views. Yet they're all wonderful starting places. They all open things up to us. And a lot of what we do in the first years of practice is work our way through all these ideas. And if you don't have a good big idea like that to work through, you need one. So you need a good big dumb human starting place, right? Because that's what we have to work with, our good big dumb human nature, good-hearted, because those are all good-hearted, right, avenues entering. So I don't mean dumb in the sense that we all are. Like the llama we saw on the road this morning, 7 o'clock, who didn't want to, it was very big. You know, they don't look so big in the field, but when they're right in front of your car, they look very, very large. This is not a deer. No, this is. So we all have that quality, but it's a good-hearted intention and a very useful way to practice. With whatever these intentions are, we practice with it, we work with it, and we shouldn't be ashamed of them. Practicing with these ideas is not just preparation for the real thing later on, either after we drop all of these ideas. That's another erroneous idea. That's the next one. Oh, I'm going to sit around this one for a few decades, right? I'm going to get past this erroneous idea to where I don't have erroneous views, and then it'll be right around the corner. Therefore, this is my preparation period, and then I'll be doing real practice when I chew through it. This practice, with whatever motivation you start with, or the second year's motivation, or the fifth year's motivation, is your real practice of digesting your life. Great energizer, too. Just don't believe in it too much. And learning to value, say, a motivation without believing in it is a great teaching along the way. Stands you in a lot of good stead, because it's the believing in your idea and your approach. That's when your ideas and goals and motives become obstacles. And then you say, but otherwise I'm confused. And after you practice for some time with some nice, reasonably clear-cut but impossible motives, then confusion can look pretty good. And it is, because confusion is really when we drop having a clear idea of what we're doing, when we have confusion, and being able to not just tolerate it, not tough it out, but be rather tender and inclusive of our confusion, is confusion as the opening to a door to wisdom, to the wisdom we have at that time. In fact, to understand that confusion is one of the flavors of wisdom. That's pretty tough for us. So Dogen offers us a deeper and wider, a really inclusive perspective that takes all of our goals and motives into account, but takes us beyond them. And this is what gets called in the Soto line, practice realization. He says, you're always practicing the Buddha Dharma, or practicing life as it truly is. And he says, life as it truly is always expressing itself without your sticking your head in it. You don't have anything to, that's a Katagiri's phrase. Don't stick your head in it. Your head is already in it. It's already happening. sometimes you know that life reality is already happening and including you, and sometimes you don't know. So we're kind of like, you know, the little kids playing peekaboo. If I see, have a sense that the world includes me, that's good. And when I don't have a sense of that, it isn't true anymore. That's our peekaboo mind. Actually, we're always included. But to live that way, being always included, so that we're always calling and responding to a world that includes us, that's our practice of practice realization at any time. Sometimes we flow with an understanding of reality includes us, and sometimes we impede that because we have this mind that says, it isn't so. I'm outside. That's something in our mind that's still included within this larger universe. For those who either seek enlightenment as a grand clashing of symbols or a pulling away, definitive pulling away of the cloudy curtain, or who think that's something that has nothing to do with me, the understanding that Dogen brought us is that there is no separate thing called realization to be attained. Nor is it just anything goes. There's no realization apart from doing the practice of realizing or actualizing or manifesting life as it is. This being, practice of being here, body and mind, accepting life and vowing deeply to wake up to this interdependent universe and to accord with it and not get so carried away by our crazy shenanigans in our mind. To wake up to this already being made of the universe without having to ask for that. There's the realization that permeates our practice. There's no realization outside of the practice of bringing forth our connection, our reality of life. And there is no practice that we do that's outside of reality. We think, well, I'm only doing this one least leakiest bit of a corner of practice, and reality is some huge thing that I barely understand. This is true, and yet you're never apart from it. We don't practice now as a deluded being to attain an enlightened state some other time. And we also don't practice as just a hopelessly deluded creature. We practice as deluded creatures made of the great reality of life. That we are already part of, that we are already expressions of. Although I'm indubitably a deluded creature, I am already an expression of reality of life happening. To refine that, to express that now, to know it, and to be guided by it, that's the work of a lifetime. That's sort of the bringing it forth. It's not as hard as it sounds because now is all there is. Now is the only time there is. And the future is made of the present. So you're already here. The opportunity of this moment of reality and life is already here. It was when I still lived in that cabin in the woods in the Berkshires that I realized that this teaching of Dogen says there's no separation of means and ends. But that's what this practice realization says. We have the idea that if I do these means, if I do something now, I become skillful with what I'm doing now, that there will be some other end or conclusion that will follow. And when it's the matter of what it is to be human and alive, it doesn't work that way. In fact, it really never works that way. The ends are never separate from the means. How you do something is never separate or apart from the result. And the result is never apart or disengaged from how you get there. You know, lies don't lead to honest results. And inattention doesn't lead to wisdom. So the means, the activity of this moment, is never apart from the end. And we all know that in a basic way in terms of kind of how to try to be honest in our lives. But it actually goes all the way completely through and through our lives. So that what we do now, the how, or the means as we think of it, as what we do right now, is in fact what the ends or goals or end, the future is made of. So, our practice right now is all there is, as these kinds of beings that we are, wavering and wobbling. And our practice right now is all we need to do right now to fulfill our intention to wake up. Right now we do what we can do to fulfill that intention. The same is true for love. I'm going to learn to love tomorrow and work. If I want to learn to love, I have to work on opening my heart right now because this is the only moment there is. If I want to be honest, I have to learn now. If now is the time to speak up, not tomorrow. Not just blurting, but this is the time of my life. This is the time of your life. This is the whole of your life. You're having the time of your life. What kind of time are you having? Always a mixed bag, in which we always have the opportunity to return to saying, well, what? This is the time of my life. Oh my God. What am I doing? What do I want to do here and now? I would like to pass. I don't have quite enough copies for everybody. Some will need to pass those around. Take those to the other side of the room. And pass them around to the side of the room. Shouldn't take them all the way over because it's going to take too long to pass them. Here, a couple. And give those to this other one. And hand the rest down. Take one, Dina, if you know the, you know where, okay. Thanks. So what I'm passing out is the first paragraph, the first lines, really the first verse, the whole thing is like a long prose poem. Of Dogen's great teaching about actualizing reality, about what is this reality and how do we find ourselves in it. Is there everybody able to cast their eyes on one? Roger, is there one more we can bring back over here for these guys? Like Roger has extras. Jason, Roger has some extras. There. Roger, would you pass a couple there and then bring a couple back? Bring one back here.
You ran out.
That's okay. Bring one back to those guys and you can look at mine. That's okay. I just like to read that together. When all things are the Buddha Dharma, there are delusion and realization, practice, birth and death, Buddhas and living beings. When the myriad things are not fixed self, there are no delusion and no realization, no Buddhas and no living beings, no birth and no death. Since the Buddha way by nature leaps clear of abundance and deficiency, there are arising and perishing, delusion and realization, living beings and Buddhas. Yet flowers fall amid our love and regret. Weeds flourish amid our loathing. in case you find it confusing, Soto Zen priests and scholars have been arguing about this ever since he wrote it, pretty much. The first line talks about the world of the many things coming and going. The second line talks about the emptiness of all those things. The third talks about the one reality that includes them, and the fourth is the perspective of human experience. This is the simplest summary. So the first line, or the first statement is, when all things are the Buddha Dharma, there are delusion and realization, practice, birth and death, Buddhas, and living beings. When doesn't mean, means at the time when you see all things in terms of Buddha Dharma, that all things are Buddhas. It's not like, well, sometimes on Mondays this is true and when on other days it's not. The Japanese toki means at the time of. Or at the time when the Buddha Dharma, the grand teaching of this universe of awakening, of interdependent life, that's Buddha Dharma. At the time when the Buddha Dharma is seen in terms of all the myriad beings, there are all these great and terrible qualities and events. There's birth, there's death, there's Buddhas, there's elephants. Elephants, there's a lawsuit on now. A bunch of environmental groups have banded together to sue Ringling Brothers to say, no, those elephants are not happy. They're being harmed. So elephants are in the news today too, as they always should be. All the myriad beings, the elephants and the manatees and the spiders and the people and birth and death, at this very time, and at every moment, all things and all events are reality expressing itself. I might say our life expressing itself, because then we can see a sense of movement. We have to include rocks and the sky of life. Life with movement of energy of all things is at all times happening in all places, universally. As an interdependent, impermanent mix and flow at all times and in all places. And all things, all of us are always that. That's the Buddha Dharma, and we're always the Buddha Dharma. It's one big puppy pile. We're all in this pile and climbing out of the pile together and squirming and mixing up. Whose leg is who's in whose mouth? This is our world. You are the Buddha Dharma expressing itself in terms of living and dying. It doesn't make sense to think that as a person I should somehow reach some stage or place where this living and dying business isn't going to affect me. You and I are the Buddha Dharma, the reality of life expressing itself as living and dying. How will we do that? As awakening and ignorance, how will we do that? Where the Buddha Dharma expressing itself as beauty and as terror, how will we do that? Those are the questions for us. That's that first line. That we are all the Buddha Dharma, the reality of life expressing itself. How will we do that? The second takes it from the other side, says, because all these myriad beings have no one fixed self, we're all what we call empty. Empty of being so completely separate. In fact, that's when we start to see that there is one reality or one shared world. We may be individual puppies in the puppy pile, but it is one big puppy pile. Maybe that's not a profound enough image for Duggan. So goes. No one is apart from all life. And this no fixed self or the empty of me, my God, but I'm not just me either. Well, no. There is a you, but it isn't just you. And it is neither as solid as we'd like it to be, nor as solid as we fear it is. But sometimes we want it to be solid. I want to know me. I don't want you, I don't want me leaking out and Roger taking it home with him and then I won't know me anymore, you know. It's kind of a little primitive level we tend to live on sometimes. But we also don't want to have such a rigid me that nothing can get in, which we also experience. Nothing can get in or nothing can get out. Neither of those is really how it is. Those are our sort of diluted subjective perceptions. To be empty of a fixed self apart from life is to be of the stuff of all potential and creativity and of the possibility of connection. If we were really not made of the same kind of livingness, how would we ever even dream of connecting even a little bit? These first two lines present sort of two sides, two views. Now we have a Zen poem, The Harmony of Difference and Sameness, that we recite as part of the morning service 2 days a week. The world of difference is the world of there's 30 some of us here, all different separate individual beings with different histories and names and identifiably different and identifiably unique. And we're also not daffodils. And we're also not incandescent lights. You know, we're different beings. We're not zabutons or zasus. The world of manyness, the world of differences, is valid. This is how the Buddha Dharma, the world of reality, expresses itself. And then that was the first line. And the second line, the world of being empty of a fixed self, is talking about the sameness of us, what we share, what we have in common, what we can, that spark. I wouldn't know what that spark was in your eye if I didn't know that it was a shared kind of a nature. I would just think maybe you had funny looking eyes. Right? But I know something is, because something, there's something that comes toward each other. That sameness is also called oneness. This is one universe. So we have a very real world of differences and a very real world of oneness or sameness. And yet they're not two separate worlds. That's in the poem described as the harmony of our understanding life in terms of difference and our understanding life in terms of sameness. So that was the foundational poem, really, of Chinese Soto Zen, Kaodong Zen, before it actually got started, but still a foundational poem of this tradition. And Dogen, what Dogen does is he builds on this. He says, well, what is this differentness or manyness of all beings? And he answers it in his first line, that the world of difference is the whole world of Buddha Dharma freely expressing itself as you and as me. That's Dogen's generative new stream. And he says, well, what is this sameness? We speak of difference and sameness or oneness. And he answers it in the second line saying, we share Buddha nature. We are empty of being walled off from each other and thus from ourselves, and we are all the world of Buddha, the one world of, there are two truths of life. There's one world of cause and effect generating itself out of itself endlessly. And then Dogen's third line says, since the Buddha way by nature leaps clear of abundance and deficiency, there are arising and perishing, and delusion and realization, living beings and Buddhas. Well, this arising and perishing and delusion and realization and living beings and Buddhas, that's our world of differences. And leaping clear of abundance and deficiency, that's the world of oneness or sameness, where we're all in this together in one Buddha nature. He starts by talking, though, about the Buddha way. What he's saying here is that he's resolving the seeming dichotomy of there's a world of difference and the world of oneness. How can I do both at the same? How can I take care of being both a different individual being and part of a universe, of one universe at the same time? And it already sounds, I can't think of it as not, except as two different things. So his resolution is the Buddha way. The Buddha way is what goes beyond the dichotomy of one and many. The Buddha way is reality as we live it, as two-legged beasts, without shrinking life to fit our individual notions. As people, we can only live out the full reality that's called the Buddha Dharma through the Buddha way, as one among many, as with specific choices and specific limits and opportunities and obstacles. And yet, if this is all one universe, the Buddha way means to treat each thing as Buddha Dharma. Living beings are the whole ball of wax. Buddhas are the whole ball of wax. Delusion is the whole story. Realization is the whole story. The sun is the whole story. The moon is the whole story. Darkness is complete. Light is complete. At this moment, what is in front of you is the Buddha Dharma expressing itself. At this moment, what is here is the Buddha Dharma expressing itself as one and as many simultaneously. It's called, it's very confusing, so we have what we call the Buddha way, or the middle way, which says, treat each thing as the Buddha Dharma now. Treat everything that arises in your, as your life. Your, this is your whole, this is your very life. Treat each thing that comes up, yourself and the other, as the Buddha Dharma now. That's the fullness of practice. Not easy, but it's here, it's now, it's our own lives and our own bodies. Can we do it 100%? Nah. To be human is to be endlessly wavering and wobbling and thinking one thing now and another thing another, and now I can see Roger and now I can see Sharon. I can't see both at the same time. If I try, I just get dizzy and can't see anything. And yet, it's as a human that we're practicing the whole practice of Buddha Dharma. The Buddha way is a practice for people who are wavering and wobbling. So, not by pretending I'm 100% Buddha am I going to be able to practice most fully, but by being as wholehearted as I can muster now in the way I am here, wake up to being here, and meet you, whatever you it is. Knowing that I'm going to get carried away, and you're going to get carried away, and forget all about being wholehearted or all our intentions or our aim to wake up to being here and now and to seeing this as the whole of the Buddha Dharma reality that I want to meet as that. The more deeply and fully I meet this moment, the more there is in this moment for me, the bigger my life is. And then I'm going to forget about it the next minute, you know, guaranteed. That's why I'm the disciple of Hopeless Tozen. Many of you know. He discovered many years ago, he said, I'm hopelessly compelled by empty thoughts. These thoughts are empty. They're just ideas in my head, and yet they drag my whole life away. And there I am, dragged away, compelled by these empty thoughts. And furthermore, he said, this is going to happen for the rest of my life. And I became a disciple with someone like that. This is what gave him the freedom to not worry about enlightenment around the corner, but to be here and now, to do the best to be wholehearted here, to keep returning to being as wholehearted as possible here and now for the sake of this reality, this life, here and now, not as a staging ground for some other. This is not practice as a rehearsal. We sit wholeheartedly, look at each other wholeheartedly, receive wholeheartedly, sorrow wholeheartedly, get lost wholeheartedly. We just, as wholeheartedly as we can, do what's before us. Now, of course, when I'm distracted, I'm not really, I may be wholly distracted, but I can't quite call it wholehearted because I don't even know where my heart is. I'm off in my head somewhere. Returning to being here and now, to caring. The feeling of it, really, is returning to caring. They tried when I moved to Sonoma County to teach me so what. Didn't take. That's not because I'm so enlightened, because I'm from New York. They don't do so what in New York. Doesn't compute. But this, there's a time and a place for letting things roll off our backs, but this moment is never so what. This life, and my life, and your life, and what's in front of us right now is never so what. It's what is. And this way, going in this direction, entering the Buddha way and practicing the Buddha way means going in the direction of having a way to go. It's not a place to arrive. Anyone who's ever done Soto-style walking meditation, Kinyan, we never get anywhere. Tiny little steps going, you don't get anywhere. But it's very good. So this way, even though you and I are quite small, our practice can be vast, because we're practicing in the vast universe without being lost as a little thing. As we are expressing our way of being this small creature as in and as this whole universe. The human experience of this is not usually so vast, and that's why we have that fourth line, wonderful line that says, yet flowers fall, though no matter how much we love them, they fall. And even though we hate weeds, they flourish. It is human to love one thing and not another. We love something, call it a daffodil and put it on the altar. I did, when I first moved here in January, put some acacias, baileyana, on the altar. It's pretty and yellow, and people started sneezing. So I, that didn't work. But one person's weed is another person's treasure. It's a right relationship to that daffodil to love it. We're not supposed to not care. Care. It's beautiful. Love the daffodils. And it's the nature of the daffodil to wither. And what am I going to do then? The petals fall and shrivel up, and I have to clean them up off the altar and get more flowers. It's our nature to regret that passing. It kind of reminds us of our own shriveling up and passing. That's not so much fun. But loving what flourishes and knowing its withering is one of the ways we express impermanence. The caring about it. It's not that this is impermanent so we shouldn't care. Love it and watch yourself feel regret when it dies. That's feelings of knowing impermanence. Pay attention to them. They're not wrong. It's a real human way to practice and experience the life of all things, is to love and to regret the passing of what we love. But is it our nature to cling to what we love and shrink from the changing and the impermanence? It's hard to say, because it sure seems to be inevitable that we'll cling to what we love and shrink from what we don't want to see happen. But that is when our relationship becomes a matter of a fixed idea that a daffodil was supposed to stay the way it is and that it's wrong for it to change. It's one thing to love it and regret its passing. It's another to have the idea fixed, that becomes very quickly fixed in our minds. A daffodil means something that's bright and yellow and shining, not something that's withered on the counter, on the altar. But there's something wrong with that. We get ideas that things should be permanently one way. And then the universe will hold still for us, because we would like it to do that a little bit. And it won't. So the sort of jerking quality we feel, the rug being constantly pulled out from under us, isn't that this is a lousy universe that jerks us around. It's that it's constantly moving, but our minds have fixed and some kind of stop frame. Oh, that's daffodil. Stay the way it is. Oh, no, it didn't. It changed. No, here's a person. Oh, no, they aren't. And the jerking is because our minds can't move at the speed that things move naturally are moving. Can we accept and work with that? That's when our delusions become the stuff of our enlightenment. That is to say, we practice with our delusions, not just to escape them. We learn from them. Like I've mentioned before, Katagiri really knocked me practically off my chair when he said one time, Katagiri Roshi in Minnesota, you don't awaken from your delusions, from your ignorance, you awaken to it. Mm-hmm. Not what I had in mind. But that is what happens. That is what happens. What we're going to see is what it means to be this deluded creature carried around. That's when we have something rich and juicy to work with. It's our real life. Weeds flourish, although we hate them. Weeds flourish in the middle of our loathing. And of course, weed means unwanted. Right? There isn't any one plant, for instance, that's actually officially designated a weed. Especially once I moved out here and had a garden, I was yanking a lot of purslane out of the beds. But, you know, purslane is great in salads. Some people grow it for their salads. So one person's weed is another person's lunch. Mm-hmm. And when I lived in the Berkshires, and I had a nice big open field, I planted dandelions. I bought dandelion seed, and I planted it. I scattered it and planted it to encourage dandelions to grow and all those wonderful little seed heads so that I could go around and poof them to encourage more dandelions to grow. And also just because it was fun to blow on them. I was only a putative adult. I still am, only. Theoretically. So, although I may love dandelions, there are plenty of things that I loathe and detest and do not want to have. My loathing does nothing to inhibit their life. I do not control them. It inhibits me. So it's another thing I better study. So this flowers fall though we love them, and weeds flourish though we hate them, is the rich humus of our human experience. And it is as this kind of human being, loving and loathing, this is a flower, this is a weed, as this kind and as no other, we do this great practice called practice realization. And it's as this kind of being that we walk the Buddha way, actualizing reality in our everyday activities, as ordinary people. So that's what Dogen wanted to tell us. That's the opening of it. And those of you who have studied it elsewhere know that someone else will say it means something else. Not so much else, but that. And yet all the different interpretations come down to the same great end, that in general they are all saying there's a world in which we're all these different individual and cockamamie creatures, and as that we are the reality of Buddha Dharma expressing itself. And this world of many is also a world of one, and they come together, are in harmony as the Buddha life of all things. And for people, that takes shape as the Buddha way. And we live it as our practice realization, making real, here and now, the only time and place we have and are, our being part of this Buddha reality. Our being, the whole of at this moment, at this time and place, all there is. Oh my God, in this little time and place, this is all there is of Buddha reality. Maybe I better do my best. That's kind of the human way of approaching a vow. Thank you.